stories that we like to tell. It's like when getting up early in the morning with our dad, and we used to go out and meet up with our uncles and work in the fields.
He was always into the winemaking side, but just did homemade stuff. But everyone loved it.
As members of the family, presenting the wines ourselves, it's very important for us, and I think it's important for people as well to put a face on the wine.
I was born and raised here. I love the family history. I love the seasons. So somewhere deep down, I knew I was coming back.
It evolved. It started with wanting to grow grapes.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 378. This week we feature Tom McKay of Tom McKay Cellars in Sonoma. Retirement is really just a state of mind. Few winemakers really retire. Why would you when you have one of the coolest jobs on the planet, right? Tom Mackey rejoined the wine business after his 30-year stay at St. Francis Winery in Sonoma to open Tom Mackey Cellars. Now he produces 500 cases of the wine he wants to make. It's a great plan. We met with Tom at a shared tasting room in Sonoma just a few weeks ago to talk about how winemaking looked like a much better idea than golfing. You can also hear Tom on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term reverse osmosis. I'm back in Sonoma, and I'm here at Tom McKay Cellars, and I'm here with Tom McKay. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing great.
It's good to see you, and good to meet you.
Good meeting you.
Thanks for taking your Sunday morning to meet with me today, because that's exactly what it is. It's a beautiful Sunday morning, so it's nice.
As beautiful as it is, I wish we had a little rain.
Yep, that's the story I'm hearing from everybody, and once I leave, I wish rain upon you.
Thank you.
It's not something I say every day. You and I were chatting a little bit before the interview just kind of about your background. So let's go back to, I guess I'd say day one when you first entered the wine business. When was that?
That would be 1974. I had wine as an avocation, a hobby since the late 60s. And I decided to change my school major and go to a oenology program, which involves a lot of the sciences. So I was going to school during the day, and I was working as a manager of a wine shop in San Francisco. I started that in 1974.
When did you graduate from that point beyond retail?
Well, once I left retail, I got into UC Davis, but I decided that I would prefer Cal State Fresno. I looked at the hiring rates at the time, and Davis was a solid 60% or so. Fresno was 100%. You go down there, you get a job. And I was going to be approaching my late 20s, and I figured it's time to get working. Mm. And so I worked while I was down at Fresno State. I worked up in Napa. It was during the fall. Took a semester off and worked up at Rutherford Hill Winery. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I got my bachelor's, and I was going for my master's. I figured that that would help me, whereas a PhD, believe it or not, I think would be deleterious to your career. In fact, you would be overeducated for a winemaker job in a small, mid-sized winery. It would be assumed that you're not paid enough and that you're always job hunting. And so I figured PhDs for research positions in big wineries are great, if not required. But as a medium, small winery winemaker, and so I got my master's degree, got a job out of in the Finger Lakes in New York.
What year would that have been?
That was 19, late 80 through early 82.
Interesting.
And so I worked the Gold Seal in the Finger Lakes. I was most definitely experienced. The winters there. I'm a San Francisco kid, so I was not used to that kind of winter. Although I did spend a couple of years up in Spokane, a couple of years at Gonzaga.
Yeah, welcome to my world.
Yeah, I know. It's driving is always fun.
Yes, there's that part. That's years of experience.
Yes,
that you never actually learn.
And when you're on the freeway, follow a truck. You're driving in a dress.
Yes. Or get the heck off the freeway.
Yeah, I had put a couple of years in New York, and then I came back to California and worked at Round Hill Winery, Rutherford Hill Winery, and then I got an offer at St. Francis in 83 as their first winemaker. They built the winery in 79 and had been using consultants, and so I was their first winemaker.
Really?
And that was 83. It was somewhat of a smallish winery, and I was offered to, I was told, they can't pay you a lot, but you have complete control, and that's fine. I can live with that for now. I worked this way up. For 30 years I was there, and we built a new winery. We increased from 90 acres to 500 acres. Went to many, many cases of wine from when I originally started. And by the time 2011, 2012 rolled around, I figured I'd done what I could there. And I had a great crew. There's a great crew there now. And so I felt that it's time to move on and either take up golf or start working on wine again. And like the old saying is, it's like the old joke is, it's in the blood, as long as you don't get pulled over. And so I started the winery in 2014, and it's always intended to be small. I've gone through the growth phase. One of the biggest treats at St. Francis would be able to help design, equip, and staff a significant, quite a big, mid-sized winery. And having done that, I didn't want to do it again.
Yeah. Well, and you knew your stuff, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So this way, I just have two partners. You met one of them, Clyde. We're the whole work staff. So we do everything. We bring in a portable bottling line, but we do all the work ourselves. And I'm finding that each year those barrels do get a little bit heavier. But moving those around, and I still enjoy it. I like it. And there's no pressure to make wine by what someone else wants, what if someone else thinks I should do. It's just how Clyde and I say, well, it tastes good. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, that's fair. It's really amazing, the experience you went through before you get to a small winery. How many cases are you doing here?
Oh, I'm making 500 a year.
Nice. Well, that's still a pretty decent size.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, compared to what I was making at St. Francis, the saying is, you know, they spill more wine than I make.
Yeah. That's...
Or filter more wine.
Do you have your own vineyards, or are you...
No. I'm too old to plant, and I wouldn't want that responsibility. There was a time when I was at St. Francis, I had 70 or so growers I was working with, and so I have a lot of friends left, and we source our grapes mostly from Sonoma Valley. We get our Cabernet from the Monticello Ranch up toward the top of the Mayacamas. We get our Cab and our Zin up there. That's Karin Lee's vineyard. We get our Cabernet and our Zinfandel from Monticello Ranch up in the toward the top of the Mayacamas overlooking the Sonoma Valley. We get our Malbec and now our Merlot from the Woolard Vineyard, also in the Sonoma Valley. And we get our Petit Verdot from the Stemmick family vineyards across the street from the St. Francis Vineyard, home branch. And we get a little bit of Petit Syrah from River Road from the Basordi Stone Ranch.
What are you primarily bottling? And obviously some of these you might be using for blending.
Well, actually, we're so pleased with the quality of the grapes that we're going to be bottling a Merlot this year and a Petit Verdot this year. And then I plan on in the future to bottle a Malbec from the Woolard Vineyard.
Nice. That's a good selection.
Yeah, and that's all Bordeaux, and we have our Zinfandel, of course, and we get a little Petit Syrah. And with our Zinfandel, Clyde and I do our blending trials, and then we get some outside opinions from good wine people, because you don't want cellar palate. We found out that, starting with this 15 vintage, we found that Malbec is a good blender for not only the Bordeaux varieties, but for Zinfandel. So we have Malbec along with Petit Syrah in our Zinfandel. And in fact, Malbec is in all our wines. The ones that I have now are solid, really good growers who turn out great fruit. And so we have contracts, and it's mostly by shake of hand, and it's almost a familial thing where you're dealing with almost members of the family and not just business partners.
That's nice. I like that.
And that's one of the things. Otherwise, like I said, I'm pushing 70. It'll be 70 this year. And there comes a time when things, you know, do start slowing down, and I want to keep doing this as long as I can.
Good.
And, I've got a significant level of appreciation for the office people who do all the work with compliance and this and that and billing and everything else, because I'm doing that now.
You know, I've said this 100 times, but you're one of the rare businesses, other than the fact that you're not a grower. You know, you're a manufacturer, you're a wholesaler, you're a retailer, you're a compliance person, you're a salesperson. You wear so many hats, your head could fall off.
Well, that's called retirement.
So, is that what I've got to look forward to?
Yes, exactly. So it's I'm going through the label approval process, TTV, with the Merlot and the Petit Verdot we're doing. And so I've heard stories that wineries my size and smaller don't even bother because it's all local sales and there's never any checks. And I just as soon avoid that headache.
I think that's a good idea because why take the chance?
Exactly.
You could get hit with a fine that would be astronomical for a small winery.
Yeah. Well, it put us out of business, maybe. But I remember some instances when our labels didn't get approved at St. Francis. It happened once, maybe twice. And so you appeal for what's called a USA permit, and they allow you to go through and sell the remainder of that particular bottling. And you may or may not get a fine, but that's better than taking the wine back, scrubbing the labels off, and relabeling, and that'd be a nightmare.
Yeah, that'll be no fun whatsoever.
And they know that. They're not going to be that adversarial.
Well, and that's the idea. You know, their government, they're there to not only, you know, keep checks on you, but to help you in the long run, you like to think, anyway.
Well, you'd like to think. And it's primarily revenue-based. So they, because I have, well, I don't want to get into the high weeds with all the taxes and everything we have, but it's eye-opening.
So for the time you've been in the business, which has been a very long time, which I think is really amazing, is there one particular lesson or one particular thing you would put above all else that was most important to you that you learned?
Things change. When I started out, vineyards were planted in what's called California sprawl. The rows were 12 foot apart. The vines were 8 foot spaced within the row. And there was just large bushy heads. And sometimes you'd have to trim it, sometimes not. With the thought being that the less sun, you don't want sunburn, you don't want, you know, dehydration, so you cover it with leaves. Well, that's long since changed. Now they've changed the configuration of the rows, the size of the spacing, the trellising, the vertical shoot positioning, where in fact you do want some sun on your grapes, except when you have a real severe heat wave, which I can remember, I think it was 06, we had one of those, and it got 122 within some of the vines themselves.
Wow.
So that was an interesting year. But in most cases, though, you have the row configuration, the shoot positioning, where you have your growing area, the leaves above and below. Then if you have to do a little bit of leaf pulling because of the excessive moisture, so, and you want to get a little more sun in there. And so that's not counting the rootstocks, the varieties, the clones. The changes are just remarkable, and I can't imagine what they'd be like 50 years from now.
No.
And in winemaking, same thing. The biggest decision in winemaking is when to pick. And so now, when I started, okay, get out the refractometer and measure it 23.5, bring it in. And now the parameters are such that the refractometer is a secondary thing. It's, you're looking at the seeds. Are they green and bitter, or are they brown and chewy? The shoot stems, did they stop growing? The leaf starting to turn color, the berry looks a little puckery. What's the acid, pH? And then finally, how easily is the range harvesting? Because everybody else is doing it too.
Do you keep a notebook of all these kind of things year to year, that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, every year I record everything. That things that are pregnant, basically when we pick, the all the numbers, conditions. It's just standard record keeping for for a winemaker. And like I said, with the viticulture, with the winery, the vineyards we purchase our grapes from, they're definitely on top of it too.
For the pick, are you, the wineries that you get grapes from, are they doing the pick, or do you have to bring your own people in?
No, I don't. In fact, there's one vineyard that I help pick. Mm-hmm. And again, that's my back lets me know when it's time to not pick. So I basically, they bring the bins in and I dump them into the hopper.
Sure.
But everything else is contract. They all have their own vineyard managers, and they schedule the picking.
From your time before to today, are you seeing issues with labor, difficulty in getting people to do these jobs?
That's an ongoing thing. I remember that going back for years and years. There's always labor problems with pickers, and I don't think it's been all that exacerbated by recent conditions. And the biggest issue is the pickers now taking other jobs that are a little bit more year-round, like construction and other things, rather seasonal picking. And so I think that people, when they can, will shift to mechanical. And we tried it at St. Francis for a while.
Yeah, how'd that go?
And it was an experiment that, no, we can adopt. But, of course, your vineyard has to be set up for it, too.
Right, so it's totally different.
Yeah, it's totally, if you have, say, a VSP, a vertical shoot positioning, a trellising system, then you can do it. If you have other systems or just head trained, then no, it's all hand.
Interesting. So again, for all the years you've been in the business, and this could go positive or negative, what makes you crazy about the wine business?
Two things. First is getting new customers, the marketing part of it, because that is constantly in flux. Just trying to keep up with the drinking trends of the wine drinking public. There's a generational issues, like the boomers now are aging, and they're not, from my understanding, the premier purchasing age group, and the younger ones are. And so what are their preferences? Competition is intense. So I think that you have to depend on your reputation, your soundness in what you do, and also people liking your style. And we're small enough to find people who do like our style. Oh, the other pricing.
Yeah, yeah.
Pricing is that's an interesting discussion, because first of all, you have to your starting point is your cost of goods, and so once that's established, then you have to consider if there's going to be any expansion and what it needs. Right now, we may have made a little profit last year, but profit is, at least in our situation, a lesser but eventual consideration. Right now, we're looking to upgrade equipment, get new barrels, maintain our growers' contracts. And so, and as far as pricing a bottle of wine, even at St. Francis, it was difficult because we were making some very top-end small lot. All our wines are great, but small-end, top-end wines, small lot. And you didn't want to overprice because you're going to sound like you're trying to rip the people off. You didn't want underprice because then they'd say, well, if you don't, you're not charging much, what's wrong with it? So then where do you put your price? You look at your competition, and then you talk to the people who are either marketing or selling or buying your wine. And you have to raise, if you're going to raise the prices, which is inevitable because everything goes up. So you have to do it incrementally. Obviously, if you win a sweepstakes award, then that's an instant notch up a couple. But we try to keep it as the increases as modest as possible. And neither Clyde or I are in here to retire on this. In fact, this is retirement. Mm-hmm. So we want to make as good a product as possible with the great grapes we have, and keep doing it while we can, and be pleased with what we make.
As it should be. Are you primarily direct to consumer, or do you have some distribution?
We have our own accounts in town, and we're looking for a couple of brokers, and here and in Southern California. And we also work through a company called Vino Shipper, which sells in about 41 states. So it removes the necessity of us to apply for permits in each of those states. That's their best thing. I tried getting a permit in North Carolina. I finally succeeded, but I started in April and I got it in December.
That doesn't surprise me.
That's crazy. And I missed, missed the summer sales, I missed the Thanksgiving sales, and I missed the holiday sales. And so...
Try for Pennsylvania. I'm only kidding.
I remember Pennsylvania is a lot easier now than it used to be when it's
really?
A state store.
That's new to me. Wow. So for the years you've been doing this, again, I seem to start a lot of questions that way, but I admire the fact that you've done this for so long. And I'm sure you've been interviewed plenty of times. What's the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
That is a good question. Well, I would like to know if there's going to be a change in the overall definition of wine. I grew up, and it is still that way, where Cabernet was a determinant of a good to great vintage. There's a lot of varieties out there, but for the reasons I'll enumerate, the Cabernet does determine the vintage. If it's a great vintage, it's great because of Cabernet, not Pinot Noir, not Riesling, not Syrah. And I guess that's been because it is the Bordeaux, you know, Bordeaux was the capital of the Western world for red wines, Burgundy right behind. And Cabernet also was a late ripener. So if it's a great year for a late ripener, then all the earlier ones should be equally as good. Whereas if you had an early ripener, like say Pinot Noir, and then it rained right after that, the Pinot Noir is great, but the Cabernet wouldn't have been. So it's curious. And also another question is, where in fact is the industry going? The changes that I've seen, it's hard to imagine what it's going to be like in 50 or 60 years. Will wine even be consumed?
Yeah, that is a crystal ball question. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you do winemaker dinners, that kind of thing? Do you go out and...
Occasionally. Yeah? Occasionally. Not like I did when I was at St. Francis.
Sure.
You go to a winemaker dinner, and the food was always specially prepared because it was an invite-only kind of event. And we were featuring our wines, and I was in town for that day or something. And but if you're on a two-week sales trip, and every night you have a winemaker dinner, I found the best way to do it is to meet yourself. You're at a table. Maybe there's eight other tables at the event. Well, you'll take a bite or two of the first course, go talk to a table until that plate is removed, come back, get the second course, have a bite of that, and then get up after that second bite of the second bite from the second course, and then go to another table, talk to them, and by that time you're pacing yourself.
Right.
And at the end of the meal, you say it's the best meal you've ever had, and it may very well have been, but you know you have 12 more of the 12 next 12 days, but that's part of when you're on the road marketing.
At least you eat well.
Oh yes. It sounds almost crazy complaining about great meals. It's also fun to see the new people, new customers, and people like wine too, and maybe they've never had your wine before and they're trying it, and so talking with them.
Are you in restaurants, or is that something?
Yeah, we're in restaurants, and we're looking to get in more restaurants. We prefer restaurants. We are in good retail outlets in town here, too, and we're looking to, we were in San Francisco, we were at, I think it's called Wallard's on Chestnut Street, and we were at the Cliff House. We'd like to get back in there, and so we're so small that most we do. Oh, I do the deliveries too.
Sure.
So and the billing.
Yeah.
And so we'd like to, you know, sell what we make.
Your experience. There's something stands out that you'd like to you enjoy thinking back on that reflects on who you are today.
Well, it's you can think back at the wines you've made, the vineyard people you've known, but primarily it's the people you worked with in the winery. And I've been blessed, and I knew a lot of really fine people. And I've worked for great people, not all everywhere I've worked. I've worked for some people that I would tend to use as a negative example. But in, St. Francis, I use that because I've been there the longest, that just the people are, I enjoyed working with the people, they enjoyed me, at least they told me. and we're still friends, I still meet with them, and my successors are just doing great there. They're making great wines. Katie and Chris, and they're doing great jobs. And I just saw one of the gentlemen I hired in 87 as cellar help, and he retired as one of my winemakers. Aww. Now his son is doing the winery management. He handles production. And the kid Octavio I hired on the bottling line, now he's running the whole thing and running the crush crew. Martin's also running the crush crew. And these are the guys I hired when they were kids almost.
I guess you did some good hiring.
I did some great hiring, although not 100%. I hired one guy on Friday, and I let him go on Sunday because he was claustrophobic and couldn't get into a tank to clean it.
That would be a bad job.
Yeah, that would be tough. And another guy was allergic to one of our cleaning agents, and he got all red. And so we had to let him go, too. And there's instances where I have a really good batting average for that, although no one bats 1,000.
No, can't be perfect, but that's pretty darn good. You have a very nice little tasting space here. Is this strictly by appointment, or how does it work?
For our winery, it'd be a by appointment, yes.
Okay. And if our listeners would like to learn more about you and to possibly make an appointment online, what is your website?
TomMackeySellers.com.
That's pretty easy. And is there a phone number for it?
Yes, it's 707-396-0883.
Excellent. Tom, this has been fun sitting here chatting with you on a Sunday morning. I appreciate your making the time for us.
I'm glad we can do this.
Learn more by visiting MackeySellers.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Copyright 2020.